Get ready for the smartest bundle in streaming. 6 streaming services for the intellectually curious. Featuring Curiosity Stream with the best collection of documentary films and TV shows. Psalm TV and great stories from the world of wine. Taste Made for the fun side of food and travel. Topic with the best thrillers and crime stories. And so much more. From nature to history, technology to food, mystery to adventure. Get 6 streaming services for one low price and less than $6 a month. It's the best deal in streaming. Learn more and sign up now at smartbundle.com.
My name is Michael Harrington, and people say I am a very sick man. This is the last opportunity available for me to tell my story. I just hope my lawyer will not dismiss what I have to say and throw it in the garbage. Every word is the absolute truth of what occurred this month. This will be the very same story I will tell in the court of law, and I hope that it is retold, unedited, word for word, to anyone who will give it the time. I write this not to justify myself or my actions, but for anyone trying to understand more of what I never could. What feels like a lifetime ago began just last month, September 14th, 2017. I sat across from my wife, Kelly. She had been glaring at me since I got home from work. Her emerald eyes, puffy and red, threatening tears at any moment. She was clenching her coffee mug so hard that her nails scratched thin lines into the picture painted on the side of the cup. A sunset with the word Hawaii written above it. "Damn it, Michael," she snapped and broke that evening's silence. Those green eyes flipped the switch from an empty stare that went right through me into eyes that burned with rage. "You actually don't give a damn, do you? You would sit here and drink coffee all night, not say a word to anyone, and you would be perfectly content with that, wouldn't you? You just don't care about any of this." "You know that isn't true, Kel," I said, staring into the blackness of my own cold coffee. I knew her moods and what right moves to make. It was best to keep calm and not feed into it myself. But given the situation, I would only last so long. It would only be so long before she said something that made me flip that same switch. "Huh," she chuckled. "Isn't true. The only thing that isn't true is when you say that you care about this family. When you say that you care about anything or anyone but yourself," she scoffed. I remained silent, remained with my head down, staring into nothingness. I considered walking out of the kitchen, but she would only follow me. I knew my wife, and she would be unrelenting in her pursuit. She would keep pressing buttons until I broke or pressed some of hers myself. "You don't care about me. You don't give a single damn. Look at you. You could care less about any of this. All you care about is when baseball season starts." "You make me sick." "Kelly," I growled, glaring up at her for the first time that evening. "I knew it. You wouldn't say a word if I didn't insult your pride. That's all any of this is to you. That's all you care about. Yourself." We all deal with stress or grief in our own ways. I tend to be the more silent, brooding type. Kelly likes to lash out at everyone around her, especially the ones who say they are trying to help. However, no matter how hard I tried to keep my cool, my wife always seemed to bring me on that same level. "That's enough." I raised my voice. I wanted to keep calm, I truly did, but there is only so much stress a man can take. "You know that me and the police are doing everything we can." "Everything you can?" Kelly rose up from the table so fast that her chair slid back, screeching its protest on the hardwood flooring before it slammed into the island counter behind her. She jousted an accusing finger toward me. "If you were doing everything you could, don't you think you would be out there right now, doing something? Doing anything?" Her finger dropped, and she shook her head like she had just caught me on the act of something disgusting. "You just want this to be done with. Then you can go back to sitting around and watching TV all night." "How dare you say that? How dare you even think that? For God's sakes, Kelly, she is my daughter." I emphasized the last sentence, biting the syllables like an animal. "Your daughter?" Kelly reached for her coffee mug and threw a wild pitch at me. If she wanted to hit me, she definitely could have. Instead, the mug flew by me and crashed against the kitchen wall, just inches from my head. It showered me with black drops of coffee, glass debris, and the aroma was instant, pungent, and cold. I shot up out of my seat. "Since when is she your daughter, Mike? Since she never came home? You're so full of it. You never wanted a daughter. All you wanted were boys." She placed a hand over her chest, gripping at her blouse. Then tears finally began to roll down her cheeks. The beads of water left streaks from her eyes that kissed as they met the bottom of her chin. "Sarah is my daughter. She is my baby." Kelly whimpered the last two words, then fell back into her seat, burying her face into her hands as she started to sob. "It isn't a competition, Kelly." I looked down at the floor, at my shoes and the specks of coffee that surrounded me. "I love Sarah, just as much as you. You're only saying these things because you're angry." "Angry?" Kelly repeated into her hands. Her glare rose out of the cover. Her eyes were pinked with tears. "If you care, then why do you never bring it up? Why am I the only one who is always upset? Why am I the one who hasn't been able to sleep and has cried every night for the past 3 months? Kelly, I still have to work. I still have to be able to function if I think about it all day. And what the hell difference does that make?" "What more do you want from me, Kelly? What more can I give you? Besides crying your eyes out and shoving the blame on me for every damn awful thing that has happened in your life, what are you doing that I'm not? What the hell else is there to do?" "I'm not giving up, Michael." Her bottom lip began to quiver. "You say 3 months like it's too long, like you've given up. You say it like you think our little girl is dead." Looking back at it now, I am ashamed. Kelly was right. I had given up on the system. It had been so long since we saw Sarah. It just seemed impossible to think that we would ever hear a word of good news in our lives again. Kelly did refer to Sarah as our little girl, and I wanted to be happy for that. It was the first time she had called Sarah ours. The first time she groped me and her together in these passing months. I couldn't be happy about it, because Kelly was right. I had given up. "I would do anything to bring her home, Kelly." I couldn't meet her eyes, or even check if she was staring at me. My eyes would only look down at the floor. They started stinging with fresh tears of my own. When I did finally look up at Kelly, she had adopted her earlier state. The empty glare that just seemed to have gone on for miles. I think I prefer the anger and tears to this emptiness. At least then I knew she felt something. We both did. Without another word, I knew why she had hidden her rage so suddenly. I turned around. Sure enough, Junior stood in the kitchen doorway. He was almost 16 now and taller than me. He still had his baseball gear bag slung over his shoulder and cap on his head. I knew he couldn't have been home for long, but it was obvious he had overheard some of the fighting. His eyes were staring at the wall with the coffee stain. Hopefully, he hadn't heard too much. "Hey, Mom, Dad," he said. His voice had gotten so deep. It was hard to imagine that he was so small not even that long ago. Only 8 years ago, he was the same age as Sarah. "Hello," Kelly said, and I watched her force a smile that tore at my heart. "Are you hungry? I can make you a snack." "No, thanks. I can wait until dinner." His eyes were still locked onto the stain on the wall, and I didn't blame him. His mother looked as if she was going to cry again at any moment. No son wants to see that. There was a brief silence, and I cleared my throat. "So, how was school? I can see you finally made it back to baseball practice. No problems with the coach or anything?" "No. Coach said it was good to have me back, and if I needed more time, that the team wasn't going anywhere." He looked away from the coffee and broken glass. "Actually, baseball practice was great. It was like an escape for everything for a couple hours. I didn't think about anything, What I wanted to say is, maybe this weekend or soon, me, you, and Mom would go to the batting cages or something. It felt good to blow off some steam." "That sounds like a pretty healthy suggestion. Let's wait until the weekend and see how your mother feels." And the phone rang. All of our eyes shot to the telephone. For the past 3 months, every time the phone rang, it seemed like there was a tear in time. The phone rang again. It was like a sort of ambiguity that loomed over all of us. It could be anyone on the other line, a relative, a telemarketer, or it could be the detective with the news about Sarah. It rang a third time. But whenever that phone is answered, that all leaves and we forget what exactly we were hoping for in the first place. Maybe someone to tell me they found my daughter and she is alive. Phone rang again. Or maybe that they found her and she is dead. Answer it, Michael, Kelly said in a whisper that I barely even heard. The trance was broken and I reached out for the receiver. Hello? Faster, Michael. Please, drive faster. Kelly spoke into the sleeve of her sweater, her eyes never moving from the freeway. I glanced over to her and checked the speedometer. We were already flying at 75 miles per hour, but I did what any good husband would and pressed the pedal down, ramping up the family focus another 10 miles per hour. All three of us sat in silence for more than an hour. Even Junior, who would normally be glued to his smartphone or at least listening to music on even the shortest of car rides, sat unmoving in the back seat. I had a feeling he was thinking the same thing as me. Kelly, as well. It didn't make any sense in the best possible way, but I had never been so happy to be wrong and so ashamed that I had given up in my entire life. After 3 months of searching for Sarah, they had finally found my little girl, and she was alive. After the first hour, it took us close to a second to reach our destination. A remote and secluded shack in the middle of the badlands of the Mojave, California. On first glance, that metal building sent a chill down my spine. It looked like something right out of a horror movie, and not just any old R-rated flick. Like the butchering hut in those movies that never make it to the theaters. Like one of those foreign B-list god-awful gore fests. That's when the pit began to grow in my stomach. Surrounding the rusty shack was what must have been over a dozen police cars. They made me feel both safe and concerned. That concern just continued to grow as we parked next to another dozen or so civilian vehicles. When I had spoken to the detective on the phone, he made no mention of any other kids or families. All I was told was that they had found my daughter and where we would have to go to get her. As soon as the tires came to a stop, Kelly was out of the car. She didn't even close the door and ran straight for the nearest policeman, which happened to be a man not far from where we parked, an officer that was smoking a cigarette next to a barrier of yellow caution tape. Stay here for now, Junior. I'll be right back. As soon as I figure out what is going on. I looked over my shoulder at him and he nodded. Then I unbuckled my seatbelt and started toward my wife. As I walked toward Kelly, my eyes began to wander around at the other cars, the families that they belonged to, husbands and wives, the occasional adolescent, young men and women around Junior's age. Most of the family's eyes appeared red, as if they were currently or had been recently crying. There was another expression some of them wore that I had recently become acquainted with myself. That same desolate and empty stare my wife had worn just earlier that day. The stare of a parent that lost their child. I began to understand that these other families were here for the same reason as me. There were so many of them, these families. But I did not see a child, not a single one that it was even close to Sarah's age. I hurried to be at my wife's side. By the time I reached Kelly, the officer she had spoken to had already gone off to talk with the other policeman. Kelly didn't say a word as I approached. She was bouncing on her heels and chewing her fingernails, her green eyes following every move the cop made. I put a hand onto Kelly's shoulder. It rested there for a moment before she placed her own on top. It was perhaps the simplest gesture a man could make to calm his wife's nerves, but it meant the world to me. After everything that had happened, it finally felt like we were together again. The weight was almost too unbearable, and the pit only grew at the bottom of my stomach. I wanted to throw up, and I wanted to faint. The surrounding eyes did nothing to help my anxiety. 20, 30, or 40 men and women, all crowding along the caution tape, or posted by their vehicles in the makeshift dirt parking lot. Their states were so loud, some with their mouths open and looking deep and empty. Like the ocean, like the living dead. The tension was building, and for a moment, I almost wanted to turn and yell at them, Tell them to shut up. They were staring too loud. Seconds only inched by and the anxiety grew tenfold. I was close to retreating back to the car. I would tell Kelly I had to check on Junior, partially because of the anxiety and partially because of our audience. But then the police officer emerged out of a cruiser. In his arms was a daughter-sized bundle of blankets. Kelly's grip tensed on my hand to the point of pain. Even at this distance, I felt as if I could see my daughter's small face popping out of the blankets. Kelly ducked under the yellow tape and ran straight to the police officer. I was not far behind. The officer held out the bundle, and Kelly snatched it out of his arms, her fingers running through what appeared to be filthy red and brown hair. Then, I was close enough to see my daughter's face. "I'm so, so sorry this happened to you," Kelly repeated, and squeezed Sarah so tight she made a whimpering sound. Then Kelly sat our daughter down so we could take a look at her. Sarah was still wearing the same Five Nights at Freddy's t-shirt that she had worn to school the day she went missing, along with the same pair of blue jeans. Both were now stained so bad and covered in various gunks that you would only be able to tell if you picked those clothes out for her that very morning. Her hair had grown down to her waist, and she was at least a couple inches taller. In these 3 months, she had missed her 8th birthday, but it seemed so much longer, like so much more had been missing or was taken away. Sarah looked at us both blankly, wordless and maybe cold, as if she were trying to figure out who we were. That thought scared me more than anything. We still had no idea what had happened to her. Maybe she really didn't recognize her own family? Sarah craned her neck and reached her small hands up at me. "Daddy," was all she said, and the only thing I needed to hear. I scooped her into my arms and held on to her like I was never going to let go again. Tears fell from my eyes and into her thick, gunk-caked hair. She smelled like copper and urine. Regardless, it was the best thing I smelt in a long time. Whatever had happened to her, she had come home to us. I cannot remember ever being that happy in my life. I was happier than when Sarah and Junior were first born. Even more so than the day Kelly wore her long white gown that she had hated so much and said the words, "I do." To me, there was no contest. This was the happiest day of my life. I reluctantly sat my daughter back down on her own 2 feet so that me and Kelly could both inspect this miracle. Sarah didn't seem to be hurt in any way. It looked as if a long bath and change of clothes would transform her into the same girl that was taken from us. Then I noticed a peculiar streak of grime down the middle of her shirt. It started from the shirt's collar and stretched all the way down to her jeans. It appeared crusty and brown, and I knew immediately that it was blood. Although worried, I could tell that Sarah was not hurt. But if it was not Sarah's, then whose? The pit in my stomach reappeared and began to grow once more. I wanted nothing more than to pack my family up and drive home, never to look back on this day, but I couldn't. I needed to know what had happened in this terrible place, what had happened to my daughter. "Sarah, sweetheart, you should go back to the car with your mother. Your brother is waiting over there and he is worried sick about you." I looked at Kelly. I couldn't remember the last time she had smiled so big, and that alone calmed my nerves. She took Sarah's hand in her own and looked at me. "I'm going to speak with the detective for a bit." I cleared my throat. There was a quick flash of concern across Kelly's face. No doubt she had been worried about the same things as me and wanted to know just as bad or even more. The concern dissipated as quickly as it had appeared. Then Kelly turned and led Sarah back to the car. It was a strange feeling watching them walk away, like I didn't want to take my eyes off of Sarah ever again. I knew that Kelly would protect her better than I ever could, or at least as passionately. Yet as they grew smaller in the distance, I still couldn't help but worry. As I watched them, I again noticed the other families, the puffy-eyed, open-mouthed, empty stares. I knew I shouldn't stare back. I had no idea what they could have been going through, what they could have been here for. Then I began to really look at the families. Before, it was just a glance, but really looking to them. There were so many. What could have been 100 or more people? They were not staring at me either. Perhaps I would have felt more comfortable if they had been. No, they all watched my daughter with starving eyes like a pack of wild dogs. Wanted to shield her from the stars, cover her back up in that blanket, and run as far away as I could from that place. Then it dawned on me, a moment of subtle clarity. These were all families, just like my own, exactly like my own. The only difference was Sarah. Out of all the families, she was the only child amongst any of us. I had to know what happened here. What happened at this location these past 3 months? What happened to my daughter? The officer who had brought Sarah back to us still stood on the other side of the yellow tape. The man's hands were in his jacket pockets, and he looked at me with tired eyes. Tired or hungry? Hungry like the other lookers who still stared at my daughter? Yet this man's hunger was aimed right at me, a starving stare that asked, "Why her?" "Michael, I presume?" the officer said and pulled a pack of cigarettes from his coat pocket, his eyes never leaving my own. "Yes. How did you know?" "We spoke on the phone." The officer took a step forward and extended a hand. "Detective Lawrence." "Oh, of course." I dusted my hand off my pants, even though it was perfectly clean, and accepted the handshake. "Thank you for everything you've done for us, Detective." I shook his hand and my excitement seemed to irritate him slightly. He grit his teeth down on the unlit cigarette. I suppose it made sense. It may have been the happiest day of my life, but judging by the scene, it could have easily been the worst night of the detectives. "It's a pleasure, Michael, but understand this is still a crime scene, so I'm going to have to ask you to stand back. An officer is already talking to your wife, so you should be able to leave soon." "I completely understand, but I have to ask a few questions first. While I have you here, while we are..." I looked toward the massive, rusty monolith, the building that had confined my daughter for 96 days. It seemed supernatural, almost like the thing oozed a kind of misery that was absorbed by everyone who looked even close to its general direction. I cleared my throat. "While we're here, officer, there are things. I need to know what happened to my daughter." The officer sized me up, starting from my shoes and meeting me back at my eyes. He pulled a matchbook from his pocket and struck one, bringing the flame up to the cigarette. He took in a deep inhale. "We already checked," he said, exhaling smoke. "There are no signs of rape or any other sexual abuse on your daughter." Detective Lawrence said it so nonchalant. I imagined he would order his lunch with the same tone of voice. Despite that, I was glad he was the one who had brought it up. No father should have to ask that kind of question. I couldn't imagine what I would have done if he had said anything other than what he had. "That is a massive relief, Detective. You have no idea. But that only raises more questions." I licked my lips. They were dry, and I couldn't remember the last time I had a glass of water. "What happened here? What happened to my daughter?" Detective Lawrence looked at me with sunken-in eyes. I guess I really began to understand how tired he was. It wasn't a sort of physical fatigue, but the entire night, the crime scene, everything, just seemed to snatch away the light from his eyes. The eyes of a dementia patient or an empty void. "Can't you just be happy that your daughter is safe? For tonight, at least? There's no reason to go through all of this right away." "Do you have children, Detective?" Detective Lawrence appeared to be a younger man, late 20s or early 30s, and appearing even older, still wearing a clean-cut beard. He answered by nodding his head, this time not meeting my eyes. "Then I need you to understand," I spoke through my clenched teeth. "I need to see what this sick prick did to my daughter." The detective's tired eyes once again met my own. "I'm not supposed to, but all I can show you is some photos, and I promise you that your life will be a lot better if you refuse my offer. Turn around and go back to your family." The way he said it was so honest and somber that I wanted nothing more than to hear his warning and kindly accept his suggestion. That being said, there was just no way I could. When a man has a child, that child becomes his life, his responsibility. No matter how badly I wanted to go home and forget any of this ever happened, I couldn't. It was my duty to understand and reason with whatever my daughter is being through, so she does not have to. Not yet, at least. "I don't have a choice. I need to know." The officer took his cigarette in his hand and flicked it away. all while shaking his head. "Follow me." As we dove deeper into the Mojave crime scene, I began to notice all the police around it. It must have been every on-duty officer in the country, maybe some off-duties as well. It seemed just as many noticed me, but paid little attention. Just a quick glance in my direction, and that was it. I did find it a little strange that every last officer I saw had a lit cigarette in his mouth, even the women. "It's for the smell," Detective Lawrence commented, as if he were reading my mind. "Most of them don't even smoke. Hell, most of them don't regularly do field work either. We had to call in everyone for this nightmare, but the cigarettes, it's for the smell." "Totally understandable. I'd take the smell of cancer over that rotting stench any day." "You shouldn't have to worry about it yourself, though. No way I'd let you get that close." I wasn't really sure if the officer was trying to scare me, but if that was his intention, it was working. The entire scene was something out of a nightmare, just as he said. Much was blocked off, but I could see the officers carrying body bags out of the building, as well as some vomiting in the distance. My anxiety began to worsen. It definitely would have been a lot easier to just go over what happened in a report or over a phone call. But nevertheless, I swallowed a lump in my throat and pressed on to the police cruiser Lawrence was leading me to. There was another cop leaning against the police cruiser with his head buried in his arms. Beneath him was a fresh pile of vomit. Lawrence put his hand on the hood of the car, and the man looked up to him and then to me. His eyes were striped with tears as he glanced over at Lawrence. "Sorry, detective, I just... "Don't worry about it," Lawrence said while waving the man away. The officer nodded to me and put a cigarette in his mouth as he walked away. "Hop in," the detective said and fell into the driver's seat. I took in a deep breath. It was the last chance I would have to turn around and walk away. I looked at the metal building and exhaled. "Second thoughts?" Lawrence asked from inside the car. He had pulled a laptop off the dashboard and was typing away. I opened the door and took the seat next to him, folding my sweating hands into my lap. "Normally, none of this would be possible, and someone else entirely would have to go over this with you. That's what's going to happen with the other families out there, but I have to make an exception for you, on the count that your daughter is alive, and I can get away with showing you some information, only because I was already working the missing persons case on Sarah. That, and nobody is going to ask about this crap anyway." "You said, because my daughter was alive." I cleared my throat with a cough. "So that means that all the other families out there, they all had missing children?" "Last chance to change your mind, Michael, before you get to see things no parent should ever have to see," Detective Lawrence said with his eyes glued to his laptop screen. I said nothing. My heart was thumping in my chest, and I looked over to the detective. He nodded and turned the laptop screen to face me. On the screen was a large rusty cage. Inside the cage was a twin-sized mattress, filthy with stains, yellow and brown. Feces and old dried blood covered the floors. On one side of the cage was a fresh pool of deep dark blood. "How? The kids were kept in these all the time?" The detective pulled the laptop away and shook his head, pressing his tongue against his cheek. "No, this was the cage where your daughter was kept. Out of respect for the other families and the other children, I'm only going to show you what you asked of me and whatever I can that has to do with your daughter." I don't understand. So we had these cages for all the kids then?" "No, you only had a cage." The detective's eyes met my own. "For your daughter. The other kids, they were kept in a similar cage, a little smaller actually. All of them crammed in there like, you know those factory farms videos with all the chickens in one cage, their arms and legs sticking out? It was like that. 33 other kids." Wait. 33 kids? Children, and Sarah was the only one who lived? Not a question. I had so many questions, but they only made me more confused. Actually, confused didn't even begin to describe how I felt. Then the detective looked at me with the same eyes he had when I first approached him. That hungry look that the other families looked at me with. Why her? Except it wasn't the same. It didn't look accusing, as I had thought it seemed. More like a person looks at an unfortunate soul or homeless person. Like he felt sorry for me. Please tell me somebody put a bullet in this sick guy who did this. Please tell me he's dead. Detective Lawrence was typing into his laptop, staring at another photo. Or rather, staring through it. Well, at least tell me he's going to rot forever. If he isn't dead, he isn't going to ever see the light of day again, right? Lawrence's finger stopped moving, and he stared blankly into the laptop. As of right now, he is not in our custody. Not yet. When we showed up to the crime scene, he was long gone. The only reason we even found this location was because of an anonymous phone call. One that I believe the suspect made. My head was spinning, and I rubbed at my brow. I wasn't sure if I was going to be sick or lose my cool and start screaming at the top of my lungs. I still held onto my sanity, for now, but I wasn't sure for how much longer. He called you out here, the man who imprisoned my daughter and murdered 33 kids. Wanted you to see it. The detective remained silent. Why? Lawrence tapped his fingers on his laptop, ran a hand through his hair, and let out a long sigh. I don't know. If I had to guess, he wanted us to see this. He wanted people to see what he did here. Why now? After all this time, why would he just stop and leave? Why would he leave Sarah? Detective Lawrence rubbed his brow with his thumb and forefinger as if to soothe a headache. You know, it really isn't fair that I have to be the one to tell you this. Like I said earlier, I have kids too. When we first entered that warehouse, it was so bad. At least a dozen kids, all hung up from hooks on a wall, cut open and gutted like animals, stripped them for their meat. He didn't feed any, just shoved them all into that cage. So many kids. Lawrence wasn't looking at me or the laptop, but through the windshield, at nothing at all. That doesn't make any sense. You said he didn't feed any of the kids, but Sarah seems healthy enough. She's actually bigger than I remember. No way she could grow like that without eating. Detective Lawrence's gaze had failed to notice me. He continued to stare at nothing at all and mumbled to himself. Kids butchered, the officer said. Butchered like livestock. Hearts, tongues, eyes. A sick guy. Then fed to. Lawrence paused and seemed to notice me again, breaking himself from his trance. Fed to what? I said in a low whisper, too scared that the detective would answer. I thought about the stain that ran down the middle of Sarah's shirt. Dried blood, relatively fresh. Then there was the blood in the cage she had been kept in. He fed my daughter? I stopped myself and threw open the police cruiser door, letting loose all the bile my empty stomach could produce. We're doing whatever we can to find him. He asked to still be in the county, but you need to get your little girl to therapy as soon as possible. If there's any good left in this world, maybe she could have a normal life. My stomach turned as I stared down at the sickness I had left in the dirt below me. You're lying. I knew it wasn't a lie. How could it be? Why would anyone lie about such an awful thing? It was already the worst living nightmare that could happen, but still it couldn't be true. I couldn't let it be. I sat up suddenly and snatched the laptop away from the detective. He made little effort to stop me. Perhaps he didn't want to fight over the computer and risk damaging it, or maybe he had just stopped caring altogether. Michael, I wouldn't if I were you, was all he said. But it was too late. I scrolled through the photos. The cage was first, then another cage. This one smaller and with rusted bars. Dried blood covered every inch. Then there were the hooks. Children with arms like pencils stuck on hooks dangling without skin. Meat stripped from their little bodies. Flies buzzing around them. Then there was the last picture I saw. Children. Don't know any better. Hell, if anyone was starved to the point of losing their own minds, they would eat anything they were given. Starvation is a terrible thing. The body eating itself, Anything would be better than that. Even then, it was still hard to believe that the little girl in the final picture, with fresh blood on her face and covering her hands, was my daughter, my little Sarah. Upon returning home, I was expecting to take the first 2 weeks off from work. I wanted to set up a plan for Sarah to get her into therapy as soon as possible. I had never expected anything to be normal after what she had been through. I wanted her to get any kind of help she could, as soon as she could, but Kelly wouldn't hear any of it. I really couldn't blame her, especially the way things began to turn out. It was better than we could have hoped for, better than I could have imagined, to be honest. Sarah was normal, for a lack of a better or more accurate term. It truly did seem like nothing was wrong with Sarah at all. It was like she never even left. She played with the same toys, drew the same pictures, and wanted to watch the same cartoons. I had read about children suppressing terrible memories when they were young, but I wondered for how long. How long until little Sarah would remember the horrors she had lived through? After the first week, I decided to go back to work. Kelly stayed home with Sarah and was even talking about putting her back into school. I didn't see any reason why I should stay away from the office. We were even picking the pieces of our relationship back up. The only fight we had since Sarah came home was when I brought up the idea of therapy. Kelly had shut that down. I never told her what Sarah went through in that desert hellhole. I just couldn't, and I didn't see any reason for her to hear it. We had been under so much stress in the time Sarah was taken from us. Our relationship was on the brink, and I was so scared Kelly would never be happy again. If I did tell her, I feared it would consume her. Regardless, she was happy, and she never asked, so I never told. After the second week of Sarah being home, Detective Lawrence called to check in and to tell me that they still haven't captured that human piece of garbage responsible for my family's turmoil. I wasn't sure if I wanted him to call again, even if they did find him. I just wanted to forget. Life was going back to normal, and it all seemed like everything was going to be all right. After all the awful imagining while Sarah was gone, then bearing witness to the worst reality. Despite that, it really did seem like everything was going to be okay. That was until week 3, when Junior came to me in my office. "Hey, Dad, can we talk about something?" It wasn't a very busy day for me. I was just emptying out my email, so I was happy for the company. "Of course, boss. What's up?" Junior started to smile, but it flatlined as he failed to meet my eyes. Instead, he looked down at his feet. "It's about Sarah. I'm really worried about her." I leaned back in my chair, putting my hands behind my head and studying the plain white ceiling. I took my time at a few deep breaths before reapplying. I knew this conversation would occur eventually, but still wasn't sure how to prepare myself. "I know, son. We all are. I spoke to your mother about looking into therapy, but she wants to wait. I think it's for the best as well. Just look at Sarah. You have to admit that she fell right back into place as soon as she came home." Junior looked behind himself and quickly turned back to me. He spoke with an urgency that I was unfamiliar with. Junior was by no means a slow kid. Actually, pretty sharp if you ask me. But he seemed anxious about something. Call it father's intuition. "If you could, would you talk to Mom again about the therapy thing for her? Sarah is really starting to freak me out." I leaned forward in my chair. After getting a closer look at Junior's face, I could tell he had not been sleeping. His lips seemed to be peeling, and he had dark circles around his eyes. I tilted my head, looking into his eyes for a clue. His composure began to affect me as well, and I began to nervously bounce my knee up and down. "What possible reason could you have to be afraid of your little sister? Did she say something to you?" "She doesn't sleep, Dad," Junior snapped. "Never, not even for a minute. She makes it look like she does. When Mom cuddles up with her and she has her eyes closed, she's faking it. She fakes it every single night. Her eyes are closed, but I swear to you she isn't sleeping." "Now I can't sleep because of it, Dad. Every night while you and Mom sleep, ever since Mom started leaving Sarah alone at night, She walks down the hallway and goes outside. I have pictures of it. He held up his phone, and I raised my hand, showing that I didn't need to see. A silence followed as I folded my hands on top of my desk. Taking in a deep breath, I shook my head. Have you seen where she goes? No. Junior shook his head and wet his lips. I've been too creeped out to follow. Like, seriously creeped out. It's the way she walks. Like a blind person, but she knows exactly where she's going. I nodded and let out a sigh, still shaking my head without even knowing it. Thanks for telling me, boss. I stood up and went to hug him. Wait, so you believe me? He said into my shoulder before hugging me back. Of course I do, son. I released my grip and then returned to my office chair. So what are you going to do then? I shrugged and scratched my head. I guess I'll have to keep my eyes peeled from now on. The day dragged into the evening, and after dinner, I locked myself back up into my office. Kelly came to see me around 10 o'clock and asked if I was coming to bed. I made an excuse about having more work, but she seemed persistent. You know, you overwork yourself, Mike, she said with a tired smile, then walked around my desk and began to rub my shoulders. I think you should come to bed with me. Work isn't going anywhere. Come on, you deserve the rest. I covered her hand with my own and stared up at her. I won't be late. Just a few more things I have to look into. All right, Kels? She rolled her eyes and gave me a kiss on the lips. I guess one of us has to work then, huh? Just don't stay up too late, all right? I nodded, and before she exited the room, Kelly looked at me one more time. I love you, Michael. And I love you too, Kelly. More than anything. By the time midnight rolled in, I was waiting on the side of my house, looking so suspicious that I feared if my neighbors saw me that they would call the police. I looked and felt like a stereotypical home invader wearing a gray hoodie and with a cigarette hanging out of my lips. I had quit 9 years ago, and only the deepest of anxieties would bring back the bad habit. This particular pack I had purchased the same week that Sarah returned to us. Midnight was becoming 1 o'clock, and I began to wonder about what Junior had told me. The last time he lied to me, he was probably too young to remember, and I could easily guess if he was in fact lying about anything. I was his father, after all. Still, it just seemed so odd. How could a little girl be up this late at night, and what on earth would she be doing outside? Regardless, if I was up much later, I would have to call out to work tomorrow. I licked the tips of my fingers and extinguished my cancer stick. Then I considered retiring for the night as I threw the butt into the neighbor's bushes. It made me feel like a punk kid again, being out so late and smoking a stogie. Back to simpler times without children or wives. But those times were over now, and I had to get some rest before work in the morning. I didn't think Junior was lying, but I was considering maybe I would have him checked up along with Sarah. He had been through just as much as the rest of us and could be suffering from delusions, night terrors. I'd have to talk to him more after work. I took a step towards my front door, and that's when I heard the front door creak open. I pressed myself up against the wall, and I could feel my heart beating in my chest. I couldn't believe that this was actually happening. I peered out of the corner of my eyes, and that's when I saw Sarah. The father in me wanted to rush to her side and snatch her by the arm. Do you have any idea how much trouble you're in, young lady? Or something along those lines. March her upstairs and let Kelly tear into her. It would have been nice. It would have been normal. Things had not been normal for months, not since Sarah was taken from me. I watched her walk up the street and then to the top of the hill that overlooked the cul-de-sac. She was atop the hill for just a moment, and then she was out of sight. I hurried along the sidewalk, keeping as silent as I could, worried and a little scared. When I got to the top of the hill, I scanned the streets. There was no trace of Sarah. For some reason, I thought about the man who had taken her, the man who no one has ever seen, the one who was still free. There was a sinking feeling that started in my chest and then fell down into the pit of my stomach. Before my imagination could take it any further, there was a crashing sound in the backyard next to me. My heart skipped a beat and I rolled my eyes, terrified of a cat or raccoon knocking over a trash can. I began to wonder if I was the one who needed therapy. I held my chest and shook my head as I heard the animal hissing, confirming my suspicion. The neighborhood was becoming lousy with these strays. Then the cat started going nuts, hissing and spitting, accompanied by the most guttural cat noises that I couldn't begin to describe, like nothing I've ever heard. Then, in an instant, not half a second later, there was a total silence. No sounds from another animal or anything else. Just total and absolute silence. That silence froze me. It wasn't like when I heard the cat knock over the trash cans and I jumped. This wasn't that kind of fear. That silence triggered something deep within my DNA. A fear as old as man itself. The fear that kept humanity alive. My instincts told me that the silence was not normal, and I should run and hide. But I couldn't. Common sense told me otherwise. I would look over my neighbor's fence, and I would either see the cat now silent, dead in the hands of a predator, or I would see nothing at all. Nothing to be afraid of, and I would call myself crazy. I took a step forward and stood on my toes. Stretching my back and neck, I peered over the fence. The first figure I made out was Sarah. She was holding a cat up into the air, but not with her hands. Not with those little hands that barely filled the palms of her father's. There was a third hand. Her small forehead was pulled so far back that it almost looked level with her neck. A long gray arm stretched from deep inside of her and exited through her maw, wrapping long fingers around the freshly killed feline's head. The arm was the same color as stone, and instead of fingernails, long white hair shot from the tips of its bony fingers, wrapping themselves around and squeezing the entire cat's body into a tight cocoon. The arm slowly retracted back down Sarah's throat. As the cocoon entered her throat, began to bulge outward, bubbling up like a grotesque frog. There was a wet grunt, and the arm disappeared hidden deep within Sarah. Upon reflecting back to that night, I would say I felt cold and sick, sicker than I have ever felt before. The fear that found itself into my conscious mind was like nothing I could ever imagine. I think at one point I went into shock. I don't remember returning home after that. I only remember entering my study door and locking it behind me, and spending the rest of that night watching the door with eyes more open than ever before, and Junior's baseball bat in my hands. All I wanted was to wake my family and run away. After what I saw that night, it was only the logical explanation. But Kelly would never follow me. How could she leave our little girl behind? I just don't get it, Michael. There is nothing wrong at all. Why can't you just let us be happy? Why do you want to change everything? Kelly was cleaning the countertops in the kitchen when I approached her. Now she had her hands on her hips and a tired look about her. You know I only care about our family. I'm just worried, Kels. Sarah's been through so much. I'm just suggesting that she go in for a routine checkup. Even if nothing happened, she is due for a checkup. And I think we should also consider a psychiatric evaluation while we are at it. She looked at me for a moment until she rolled her eyes and took a step closer. All right, Michael, Kelly said with a small smile growing at the corner of her lip. She walked up to me and kissed me on my lips. Only because I can see that you're actually worried. Whatever helps your mind rest. I stared into her beautiful green eyes. I've looked into them so many times that I knew exactly where to look for the specks of gold within the emerald that was her iris. Then Kelly walked away and down the hall towards Sarah's room, and the pleasant memory and feeling of my wife's soft lips on mine both disappeared. All I could think of was that long gray hand that stretched out of Sarah's throat. It couldn't have been real, but I knew it was. There was no explanation. I needed my family to be as far away from Sarah as possible. My mind was made up. After dinner tonight, I'll take her to as many doctors as I can. Surely one of them will find an answer, or at the very least, a reason to keep her. Keep her away from us. Junior was a little late home from baseball practice that evening, but when he was home, the first thing he did was rush up to me, dropping his baseball gear bag on the kitchen floor as he hopped in the seat to my side. Is that really where that belongs? I asked him with a raised eyebrow. What? Oh, I'll take care of it in a second. I didn't see you this morning. I was worried until Mom said you were sleeping in the office. You saw her, didn't you? Tell me you did. I had been cleaning the stovetop, but I stopped in that moment. Turning away from Junior, I pulled in a long and cold breath. Yeah, I saw her. You said you never followed her, right? No way. I tried to, but couldn't. I was just way too freaked out. That's why I came to you. So what does she do? Where does she go? I walked to the coffee pot and poured myself a cup. Looking into the dark black liquid, I saw my reflection. Sarah is really sick. What does she have? I have no idea. Parasites, maybe? If I had to guess something like that. I haven't told your mother yet. I don't know how. But tonight after dinner, I'll be taking her to the hospital and they're going to have to sort this out. I just doubt they have ever seen anything like this. Just try to avoid her until then. It should be fine. I mean, it has been up until now. I turned away from the counter and approached my son. Putting my hand on his shoulder, I smiled. You did the right thing coming to me with this. Thank you for that. Thank you for believing me. I'm your dad. I believe you no matter what you told me. Hey, do me a favor and pull dinner out of the oven in about 10 minutes, all right? I'll go grab Mom and your sister. I started towards the hallway, and about halfway down I shouted, Kels, dinner's about done. Come on, ladies. When I approached and knocked on Sarah's door, I spoke up again. Hello? Where are my two favorite girls? When there was no response, I assumed the two had been napping. A habit they had picked up together in the few weeks Sarah had been home. Kelly really couldn't take her eyes off of Sarah. Not for long. I considered that a good thing. I really did now after bearing witness to what I had. I opened the door. It's so strange when we see actors in a horror movie see something awful, and they either freeze up, scream at the top of their lungs, or run away. I only see those reactions applicable in certain situations, like, say, a bear chasing you in the woods. But even then, true fear, true terror, is nothing like that at all. Especially when you add pain into the equation, like a loved one being hurt right in front of you. When a bear chases a person in the woods, it's a primal fear. If you have a weapon, you fight. If you don't, you run, and those are your only options. When it isn't that simple form of animalistic fear, whenever it's emotional fear, you freeze up. Whenever I saw Kelly on the floor with her eyes scooped out of her skull and her mouth stretched, open wide, blood flowing down her chin and onto her favorite white blouse, her arms and legs spread eagle upon a pond of her own blood, her chest cavity ripped open wide and organ meat scooped from her insides. When I saw that, there was no initial reaction. There was no blood-curdling scream. In that situation, the only way I can think about describing what happened is oblivion. I was crying, I know. Not tears running down my face or anything like that. The ugliest cry I could think of. Snot and tears and spitting as I reached for my wife's body. But then retreating my hand back, trying to make sense of what happened. Trying to make sense of anything. Then there was the pain. An indescribable feeling. A crushing pain that still presses upon my chest at this very moment. I've done my best, but nothing could ever begin to describe the horror that I felt that night. Looking upon my mutilated wife and the creature that hovered over her, and I will not describe anymore. The monstrosity that wore my daughter, like a snail wears its shell. The gray devil spilled out of Sarah's mouth and dragged her behind like a knot on the end of its rope. Slender, gray torso, the same color as yesterday eve. It suckled upon its greasy, blood-stained fingers, looking up at me with white, colorless eyes. The thing pulled its fingers from its mouth and let out a high-pitched scream, a scream that did not belong to this demon, but sounded more like my 8-year-old daughter throwing a fit. The shriek broke me from my stupor just in time. The creature advanced toward me with appendages that looked like dirty pieces of thick rope. Sarah's body slithered snake-like, trailing behind the devil like a tail. Junior! I yelled as I turned on my heels and began to run down the hallway. I did not make it, even halfway, before I felt a tug at my ankle. I fell to the ground hard and fast. The force knocked the wind from my lungs. I rolled onto my back and saw the horror close up now. White hairs shot from its fingertips and wrapped themselves around my legs, cutting through the jeans and meat of my leg like razor wire. I cried out and the creature reached its free hand forward, moving it toward my throat. The thin white hairs thrashed like eels from the tips of its fingers. The creature looked up and a second later there was a metal flash as Junior's baseball bat soared through the air and made contact with the creature's face. There was enough force to rip the creature off of me and send it on its back. Before the creature had hit the ground, Michael Jr. already had the bat raised up to the sky and brought it down on the fiend's skull. Every time Junior brought the bat down on the thing, it made a grunting sound that sounded like my 8-year-old girl, and every time it tugged at my heart. But Junior was not fooled. He kept beating into the thing until it turned into a gray gel and liquefied into the carpet. The only thing that remained of this fiend was Sarah's body. Laying face down in the hallway, her head was still stretched back, so both her bottom and front teeth were against the carpet. I felt like I was going to be the worst kind of sick. I couldn't tell you how much time had passed, or when I got on my feet. Junior had moved to my side, and we both stared down at Sarah's distorted body, wordlessly. After a bit of time, I was tempted to offer Junior a drink of stashed whiskey, but he was the one who broke the silence. "Where's Mom?" His eyes were still locked on Sarah's body lying in the hallway, the gray slime that dried on the carpet. By the way he asked the question, I knew he had guessed what happened. The wound in my heart was still too fresh. I thought about Kelly's body in the room down the hall and I nearly shut down. All I could do was shake my head. Junior finally looked over to me, then looked back down as I confirmed his suspicions. "God," Junior said, and buried his palms into his hands. "This is so messed up. Just so messed up. What the hell even is this? What do we do, Dad?" "We have to call the police," I coughed. "Tell them what happened. But I don't think they'll believe any of this." "We will tell them everything that happened." Junior threw an open hand towards Sarah. "They will see this everywhere. I mean, it's still leaking out of Sarah. Scientists will test it and find that it's... whatever the hell that thing is. Whatever the hell this is. What the hell is this?" I still felt the shock, but Junior was making sense to me. I felt like I was going to shut down, but he was the one who saved me. He was the one who was still keeping his cool, thinking on his feet. "You're right. That's all we can do then, and hope. Hope for the best." Suddenly, a loud beeping came from the kitchen, the fire alarm. I looked at Junior and assumed he never took the dinner out of the oven. "The police will be coming even sooner if the house catches on fire. Come on," I said, then made my way out of the hallway. I grabbed a pair of oven mitts and pulled the burnt lasagna from the oven, the alarm still beeping above my head. I stared into the burnt pan, filled with red and black goop, a disgusting and unappetizing burnt smell stretching out of the meal. The last meal Kelly would ever make. The image of the monster that had come out of Sarah continuously flashed inside my head. My family, I had lost all of them, except for my son. At least I had him. I turned to see if he had followed me out of the kitchen, but he was not there. "Junior?" I shouted, and there was no response. I began to run. I ran into the hallway and seized up. If there was a God out there, I don't want his sympathy. I don't want there to be a God. Not after what he has put me through. When I turned down the hallway, it was too late. Junior was already on the floor, and blood poured from the massive wound on his neck. His lifeless eyes looked up at the ceiling, up at nothing. Sarah was on all fours next to him, her jaw unhinged. She swung the top of her head upwards, so her mouth was open at nearly a 120-degree angle, and then she dropped it down on Junior's neck once more, severing his head from his shoulders. It rolled lifelessly on the floor and stopped whenever Junior's dead eyes were upon me. Those emerald green eyes, same as his mother, the ones where I could pick the specks of gold out from the green of the iris. Sarah, or the demon she had become, was so focused on her meal, she didn't notice me picking up Junior's baseball bat off the floor. I've described my wife and my son's deaths. I will not describe the scenario where I smashed my own daughter, or whatever she was now. There's no way I could tell you how that feels. Bringing a bat down on the one you swore you would protect. The one who has everything to me. A father is supposed to do everything in his power to protect his children. I won't describe the sound. I cannot describe the feelings. She's gone now. After breaking her skull open, I put her in the oven. I will not describe her screams to you, but scream she did. I still hear it at this very moment. There is nothing left. And I will be tried for the murder of my entire family. I don't care about proving my innocence. I have no reason to care anymore. The only reason I write any of this is to warn people. I have no knowledge of what the person who did this to my family looks like. But if I can warn anyone about this, then maybe they can find out why it is he had done this. This brings the Michael Harrington account to a close. He had written another page, perhaps two, but destroyed both and refuses to speak any more on the subject. The entire reason he would ever share this account was when I spoke with him about the man who took Sarah, the one who has never been caught. But children are still going missing. I don't know if Michael can be trusted by his word. When I spoke with him, he was definitely not the same anymore. But one thing that remains fact is what happened in that steel complex found in Mojave, California, and what continues to happen on this very day. Children are still going missing everywhere. We have reason to believe at this point that there could be multiple child snatchers. We do not know their motivation. But stay vigilant and contact the authorities immediately if you see anyone fitting the description. The only clue we have as to the appearance of the child snatcher or child snatchers is a clue given to us by Mr. Harrington. He left this part out of the story, but has given me permission to share it with the public in hopes of bringing this individual or individuals to justice. At one point, Sarah referred to her captor as the Gray Man. Once again, if you have any information or see anyone who could resemble the Gray Man, please contact the proper authorities.
New on Curiosity Stream. Get ready for the best of the best with our 100 Days of Curiosity, featuring fan favorite titles like Light on Earth with Sir David Attenborough.
Join me on a journey like no other.
Stephen Hawking's favorite places.
It's a crazy world out there.
The History of Home with Nick Offerman.
Not my home, just homes. Other people's homes.
And many more. Don't miss 100 Days of Curiosity, happening right now on Curiosity Stream. Annual plans are $20, just $1.67 a month. Visit curiositystream.com.